someone one day. Some things were sent to make me.
Every Woman is a feminist show about women and girls making a difference and the men who support us. As 50% of humanity and 53% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, KKFI staff, volunteers, board, or management. Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart with Amy Bell in the studio here at KKFI at 39th and Main Street. And our guest is Maja Devine, an author and speaker. I know she's gotten rave reviews whenever she's talked out in the community. The book we're going to talk about today is The Voices of Heaven, which is about her experience growing up in South Korea. And we'll have some discussion about the correlations to the U.S. and South Korea. Good afternoon, Maja. Thanks for being here today.
Good afternoon, Sharon. Thank you for inviting me to this wonderful radio show, Every Woman. I am all for equal rights for women. When 50% of the world population is women and 52% are U.S. voters. So I'm very honored to be on this show. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And so how did you find it growing up in South Korea? You were there during the Korean War.
Yes. I was 7 years old during the Korean War. Even before that, I have a story to share with you. It was a patriarchal society, totally male-dominated values every day for men and women to have to follow. Attributed to Confucian ideas, but I know in other parts of the world, male values dominate in regions where there are no Confucian values there. But anyway, in Korea, it was Confucian. And one of the values they adhered to strictly was son preference, male baby preference. And that was because male babies were needed for every family's welfare, because at that time there were no Social Security or welfare set up, and so male babies were their insurance policy and welfare system. But even after all those welfare and Social Security system have been set up, male babies are still preferred even today, and I can share with you later more.
Okay. Great. And what prompted you to write this book about your experience growing up there?
I was 5 years old when my father and mother, because they did not have a male child, they needed to do something about it. And so they brought a mistress into the house to live with us, so that the mistress would produce the male baby my mother could not produce. And, of course, my mother and father, being deeply in love with each other, this tore them apart. Tore their hearts. And my mother was crying as she was preparing for a feast to welcome the mistress coming. And I was 5 years old watching my mother chopping spinach and carrots and crying. And that became a deep, deep wound in my heart. And one day I knew I would have to write about it, although at that time I had no idea I would actually become a writer.
And at that time, did you really understand what was happening in your family?
Yes. I was 5 years old, and because adults in the neighborhood and our family, the relatives, all said my mother was very, very sad about the mistress coming, and this was because I was not a boy. There was no ifs and buts about it, why the mistress was coming to live with us. It was because I was not a boy. I should have been a boy.
Yeah. Well, did the mistress produce a boy?
Eventually, yes. She did produce 4 boys and 1 daughter. At that time, of course, nobody knew that it's the male that determines the sex of the baby. And if they knew that, Korean women who suffered through having to get mistresses to live either outside the home until they produced male children and the male children were brought into the house, or to have mistresses living in the same house, they would have screamed and they would have said, "Hey, you don't get second wife or mistress. I get another husband."
I was just going to ask, what do you think the likelihood would be if that situation were developed with the knowledge that it was the men who determined gender of a baby?
Yeah, that would not have happened. But actually, even after science, technology proved that... And Koreans became aware that it's the males who determine the sex of the baby. Males continued to have mistresses. And even after their wives gave birth to healthy male children, they were still engaged in extra activities in those societies where male-centered values dominate. Males did this.
And what kind of status did these mistresses have?
All right, that's a good question. The mistresses came from pools of different types of minority population. They were generally very poor, from very poor families, who couldn't afford to feed their daughters. And sometimes they got into agreements with families needing male babies to be produced, and they were offered as mistresses. In our case, the mistress who came to us was because she was rejected on her wedding day for something that's not her fault. And so she was sent back to her native home. And once a woman has been rejected, nobody would offer to marry her. And so she became a candidate for mistress jobs position. Women who fell into bad luck or ill luck or unfortunate circumstances became candidates for this type of work.
And you said in 94, how many baby girls were aborted?
Yes, 1994 alone, 30,000 female fetuses were aborted in South Korea, solely based on son preference culture. That's because in 1970s, South Koreans decided to limit the size of their family to 2 children per family, which meant that if they had a daughter first, the second one had to be a boy. And Earlier, I mentioned the reason why they preferred boys, but the second reason may be even more important. The second reason they wanted boys is because without the boys offering ancestor worship ceremonies three times a year, on the death date of ancestors and the Thanksgiving and New Year's Day, without male children offering ancestor worship ceremonies, dead ancestors did not go to heaven. They became wandering ghosts and caused a lot of ill luck on descendants. And so for the well-being of the descendants, taking care of the dead ancestors' spirits by offering these ceremonies was important. And so when they decided to limit the children to two per family, and the medical technology of ultrasound and sex detection devices became available in 1970s, and that's when the female fetus abortion soared. Mm-hmm. But it went down now.
And have they decided people can have more than two children now?
No, they still try to limit to two children, but for various reasons, one of them being Christian influence. Christianity is not exactly the model gender equal kind of religion either, but at least they did not believe in abortions. Whether female or male. And so the Christianity had a lot of influence. And other South Koreans went abroad to study to get PhDs. South Korea is second only to Taiwan in terms of the number of PhDs per capita. And these young people, men and women, studying abroad brought Western ideas about gender equality. And so the abortion rate has gone down now. And so the sex ratio at birth of male and female now is almost normal in South Korea. But it's still 107 boys to 100 girls. The normal rate should be about 105 boys to 100 girls, and which means they still are aborting female babies on the basis of some preference.
You know, I am really blown away by a statement here, and that is kind of that the abortion rate lowered in South Korea for a combination of influences. One being notions of gender equality and feminism, and the other being Christian morals. And here, I feel like those are opposing forces. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it seems like they work together, and it actually has improved outcomes for girls in South Korea.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, I have heard in the past that because the girls have the Y chromosome and the boys have the J chromosome, that the male baby is weaker and there have to be more male babies procreated for the birth rate to be equal because many of them don't make it.
Right. That's why countries and societies are striving for population balance, sex balance. They go for 105 boys to 100 girls. I am not sure about weaker kind of genes for boys, but they do have a little more testosterone-driven risk-taking behavior, which causes them early death. Mm-hmm. And so for various reasons similar to that, males don't live as long as females. And so to balance them out, they go for 105 boys or 104 boys to 100 girls.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Do we do that in the U.S.? Do we have any statistics like that?
Oh, if countries are societies are left alone naturally without intervention, the birth rate, sex rate is supposed to be about 100 to 100.
Really?
I think in the United States it works out to be about 102 boys for every 100 girls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was Una Nowling, who Una and Fiona are sitting in with us for the past few weeks because they are learning to operate the board. So we'll
and they're going to be just joining us more regularly on Every Woman because we like having more people here to join in this conversation, especially since Una was able to pull out the birth rate of men to women.
Yes, every fourth Saturday, they will be regulars on Every Woman, Fiona and Una. Mm-hmm. And so, again, back to your book, how did life go for you as a little girl in South Korea?
So I was told I should have been a boy just about every day of my life. And then the Korean War broke out. Actually, for me, this is a terrible thing to say, but the Korean War breaking out was an excellent opportunity for me because we evacuated from Seoul to southern part of Korea, and nobody knew our family background. Nobody cared whether I was a boy or girl because they were more concerned about how many people were getting killed every day, UN and U.S. soldiers and Korean soldiers. And so I was free for 3 years of during the 3 years of Korea. Korean War, I was free from anybody saying, you should have been a boy.
And at that point, the boys, of course, had to join the military, perhaps.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And now here in the U.S., we're seeing more and more women join the military, mm-hmm. and there's a big brouhaha about whether they should be in battle, and I think women have actually, does anyone know that for sure? I think women now can be in battle, can't they?
They always could be in battle. They just were also allowed to not be paid for being in battle.
Oh, really? Mm.
So that was what the actual debate was, is that some women who had already been in battle sued to make sure they got paid for being in battle. And they did, in fact, win that. Mm. So women are in combat.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. In Korea, that probably will never. Well, there are some women in the military. Actually, I do know some a Korean couple. The husband and the wife are military officers. And actually, she is higher ranked than he is. And but they are a happy couple.
Do you get back to Korea often?
Yes. Since my book came out, I've been on tours giving talks on my book, including Korea and Italy and other countries too, as well as all over in the United States. And so I've been going to Korea more often since the book came out. But this year, we will be going there to live there for a whole year because of a Fulbright award that my husband received to teach at a university that I graduated from. So, yeah.
Well, that sounds exciting. We weren't going to mention your husband, but I guess it's okay since you've brought him into the to tell what he retired from.
Oh, he was the director of the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri, for 13 years, and he retired in 2014. And since then, he's been promoted to a more prestigious job, being my chauffeur.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a good job.
Although I do drive, so. Yeah. But he, when I go to places like Italy to give a talk or give a reading, he insists on being my baggage handler.
Well, that's good. That's good. You have more things to share from your book.
The book was reviewed by Kirkus Review, and this is what it said. I like this because this points out that my book really brings out the Korean culture that is not dealt with commonly by other books. It says, a realistic sketch of a Korea that few Westerners have seen, a complex, uniquely Korean love story that shouldn't be missed, is what it said. And I gave a TED talk about this, and the TED talk really briefly gives the importance of the sun preference culture that was described in the book and how that applies even today to South Korean society and how the male values cause the life of working women in Korea not very happy. The Economist, for example, has been running graphs, charts, and statistics on the ranking of advanced countries which show where is the place that working women find the happiest. And Nordic countries, Sweden and New Zealand, New Zealand is not Nordic, but those usually take the first places, and the very bottom place that show the worst place for working women is South Korea.
And then you said Japan was
Japan
next
is the
next bottom.
Yes, next to the bottom, even though Japan has been an advanced country for way longer than South Korea.
Well, we actually had a woman on, it's been 2 years now, that was telling us about how recently it became illegal for Japanese employers to just fire someone for becoming pregnant or to just harass them until they quit.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that sort of similar thing is happening in South Korea.
Yes.
Because when you're talking about the workplace being hard for women, mm-hmm. what are we talking about here? Are we talking about pay disparity? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about, you know, in America, it used to be once women were married, they weren't even supposed to have work anymore.
So, okay. Labor statistics coming out of about Korea show that it is extremely difficult for South Korean working women to reach the CEO levels or legislative position levels. According to the International Labor Organization statistics, South Korea is ranked the last with only 5% of working women reaching CEO levels, and Japan and Turkey, 9%. Mexico, 24%. Russia, 37%. UK, 34%. And U.S., take a guess.
Oh, boy.
13?
Oh, no. 45%.
45% of women are
US
reaching
is
CEO?
Yes. U.S. is doing the best among the world advanced countries. And another area where South Korean working women are really doing well is maternity leave. In terms of maternity leave, they get like six months paid leave. And husbands get leave too. And so in that area, they're not doing badly. But in terms of the promotion chances going higher up, and also hiring back women who had babies. Or earlier, she mentioned being fired for being pregnant. Well, they just don't like that either in South Korea. They prefer to hire men so that they don't have to deal with women's pregnancies and pregnancy leaves. Once women have children, and they want to come back to the workforce, that coming back is very difficult. So all these figure into making South Korea the bottom on Economist ranking.
I mentioned to you, we've had several shows that say that Asian women in the United States are the highest paid because typically, back to the education levels and PhDs, they go into the STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yes.
And so in the U.S., I can't remember now what the statistic is. If women earn 77 cents on a dollar, I'm thinking Asian women, and maybe Una will know that.
I know that in STEM fields, I recently gave a presentation where I had researched and found that women were at somewhere near 83 to 85 cents on the dollar.
Okay, and typically Asian women are in those areas.
Only in fields like stem cell research. That's a highly, highly technical area. And overall, South Korean working women, I don't have the percentage number, but their majority of them are in fields that are not highly technical like that. And so they, women, Korean, South Korean feminists, activists, organizations and individuals are pushing for more and more women to get into these technical math and science areas.
Well, I know in the era I grew up in, I mean, it was just a known fact that girls couldn't do math. That was just the, that's just what was said. You know, girls aren't good at math.
Right.
Anybody else have any experience with that?
I think it wasn't that girls weren't good at math. It was just that they kind of encouraged, maybe not even encouraged, but really just kind of made this culture where, well, math isn't fun, and I don't like math. But, you know, they never tried to convince anyone otherwise. Like, oh, no, let me show you how cool math is when they got them saying, I don't like it.
And I think teachers had a lot to do with it. Teachers were also very gender biased at that time. And when female students excelled in math area, maybe they did not offer enough encouragement and praises. Mm-hmm.
Did you have something to add, Una?
I was just going to say that I did always get the impression in at university and even through graduate school that the math, the entire math culture was very masculine based. Example problems almost always featured males in them, for instance, mm-hmm. or boys.
Uh-huh. Yes. If I may share a personal story, our daughter is, one of the two daughters is an engineer, and when she attended some workshops for engineering students, she at first enrolled in co-ed workshops, and she soon realized that the boys were all doing the hands-on experiments, and girls were all watching them. And so quickly she quit going to those workshops, and she attended only all female engineering student workshops where she could do the plumbing, the wiring and all that herself.
It happens that I'm an engineer by training. I'm a mechanical engineer, and in our laboratory classes, I did notice that the girls almost seemed to be pushed out of the way by the boys that wanted to be hands-on, and the girls were relegated to, well, you take down notes or you write up the experiment while we're going to attach the thermocouples and do all this stuff.
Yeah. Or go get me a cup of coffee.
it wasn't quite that bad.
Yeah.
No, and typically it's not even you take the notes. It's, oh, shucks. My handwriting's just so bad. I better not write down numbers because I won't even know if it's a 9 or a 7.
I've actually had that. I work as an engineer in the industry. I've actually had that said to me several times. Well, Una, you're really good at taking notes. Why don't you take them down? Because you won't be able to read my writing.
I have been known to actually work on making my handwriting less legible to make it really clear that, oh, you want to talk about bad handwriting? Well, let me show you my bad handwriting because it's going to get worse.
Well, our guest today is Maja Devine, author of autobiography, The Voices of Heaven. How did you choose that name for the book?
Oh, that's a good question, too. My mother's real lifetime name is Chun. And means the sound or voice. Chun means heaven or sky. So I just took her name literally and translated it to the voices of heaven. Yeah. In a way, it's also a metaphor. Confucian values, male-dominated Confucian values were like 10 commandments for Christians. We obeyed those rules. In one of the rules is men are yang force. Women are yin force. Yang is sunny, positive energy, all the good things. Yin is the darkness, feminine side. This idea dominated the whole culture. And so I grew up with that dichotomy.
I just can't help but thinking, yes, I am the darkness.
And proud of it?
And a little proud of it, yeah. We do need to take a brief station break, and we will be right back to keep this conversation. This is really, this book sounds very interesting.
Thank you.
I'm really enjoying this conversation.
Thank you, but don't read it, please. You know, I have to tell you that this is a Confucian joke. In Confucian society, one of the values that we are taught is be humble, be modest. You don't brag. And so if you're a writer or artist or carpenter producing any kind of product, and you don't say, oh, I have a wonderful product. You say, I have a very bad book, and means... This is how a Confucian author would talk, so please don't read it.
Okay. And we're going to pause for a message?
We are going to pause for a message.
Supporting KKFI, Cupini's, Italian cuisine for the whole family at 1809 Westport Road and where you work. Cupini's has many options such as box meals, pasta, paninis, and desserts. Catering is also available for any occasion, including lunch meetings and business dinners. Cupini's at 1809 Westport Road is a family-owned and operated Kansas City business and are avid supporters of KKFI. Cupini's.com for your catering needs.
PeaceWorks is holding its annual Memorial Day Walk, Ride, Die-In, 8 a.m. at the entry to the old weapons plant, Bannister Road, east of Troost, 11 a.m. at Prospect and Missouri Highway 150, 12 noon at Highway 150 and Botts Road at the new weapons plant. All are welcome. For more info, see PeaceWorksKC.org. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Sharon Lockhart with Amy Bell on Every Woman, and we're talking with Major Devine about her autobiographical book, The Voices of Heaven, and growing up in South Korea. And I said to her out in the green room, well, how does it compare with the U.S.?
You mean gender issues?
Gender issues.
Yes. Compared to U.S. Gender level of gender equality, which I mentioned earlier, I refer to 45% as the number I saw of the number of working women in U.S. reaching CEO levels, as compared to only 5% for Koreans. And so relatively speaking, South Korea is still way behind United States. And personally, when I came to United States to live here, I just love this culture, because compared to where I come from, you're free. I mean, you're just way advanced. You're very liberated. I don't feel such strong discrimination against me because I'm a female. Here and there, I felt some discrimination on the basis of my race, being Asian, non-white, but not as a female. So, that's what I find.
Well, what year did you come to the United States?
1965. I came to St. Louis University to do my graduate work in English literature, which I finished. And I went back to Korea and I taught at a women's college. And I plan to live there and teach, use my education I received in the U.S. and teach Korean students all my life. But my husband came as a Peace Corps volunteer, and that's how I ended up, getting married and coming to this country to live here.
And what year was that you moved back here?
1970.
1970, mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so you've been here a while.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And You said you had a passage in your book that you thought you might like to read to us, did you?
Oh, sure. I will just read. This book is not the memoir I wrote at the beginning. The memoir had only my voice, but this one is actually in the format of a novel. And one of the ways that this is different from the memoir is it is multi-voiced. It's written from many different points of views of main characters. And the main character, of course, one of them is the mistress. And so I'll read a few lines from her voice. "Stifle your laughs," Mrs. Chung told her daughter, Suyang. "Laugh? Why would she laugh? Tomorrow she would slip into bed with another woman's husband, his life lying in a room 3 feet away behind thin rice paper doors. That's how her life as a mistress was to begin. So what happy tune would she be wriggling her shoulders to, giggling like an idiot who couldn't tell red beans from black beans?" And if I may read a few lines from the wife's point of view, my mother, the first wife. "Welcome to my husband's bed," Chun practiced the words she must say to the woman coming tomorrow. "Bear him a son," she added. Would you like me to read one line from the husband's point of view? Just one line, the husband's point of view. Something was wrong with his private parts. Since it's a rather attention-getting line, I'll stop there.
Yeah. It's interesting that, I'm just finding it, wow, why didn't the woman leave after she had the son? Why did she remain and have, what, 5 children in total with your father?
Where would she be going to? She had hardly any education. She probably had, at the most, elementary school education. She couldn't go out and get a job and make a living on her own. She would have to go back to her own parents' home. And returning to the parents' home is a huge shame. The parents, when she became, this woman came to my father's house to live there to bear a son, the parents said, "Don't ever come back to this house and disgrace us. Be a good wife there, and you belong to his family."
I was going to ask, what is her status as a mistress a little bit further? We talked about this towards the beginning.
Right.
But did she get paid?
Ah, no. She got paid in food and clothing, and she was one of the lucky ones, really, because she had a home. My father and mother and my grandmother had no desire to kick her out, and she had a home, and my mother was a very good, ideal Confucian wife, which means she treated the mistress like her own younger sister. And the mistress also looked up to my mother as though she were her older sister. So there was a kind of, this is a very interesting twist on the feminist theme here. They were not in a rivalry kind of situation. The dynamic that developed between the two women was more harmonized, feminist, bonding or strength that they found in each other's womanly company.
And how long did it take that kind of relationship to develop? I mean, how long did the mistress live with you?
In their internal struggle was tremendous, of course. Sharing one husband, you know, my father spending the night with my mom once or twice a week and the other nights with the mistress. You know, this was very difficult. But the Confucian culture was in support of this type of family relationships. The Confucian culture that said you must have a male baby supported their relationship and family situation. And so, but other women who are not as lucky, I would quote unquote lucky, as my, the mistress who came to live with us, they were out there, kept outside the home of the guys. And then when they gave birth, the women gave birth to male children, the children were taken away from them and brought to the wives to raise, because that gave the children legitimacy. And so the women were paid off. If they were lucky, they were paid off. If they were not lucky, they were just cut off without any pay, and they had to go look for somebody else to bear children for. And no, our mistress was not paid officially in terms of money, and her legal status was zero. The children she bore, four boys and one daughter, they were all listed on the family registry as the children of my father and his first wife. And so I became the first of six children in the family.
Did your mother have any other children?
No. Actually, this goes into another side of the feminist story. I didn't realize this, but when I was getting ready to come to the United States to do graduate work, I was told by someone that I was adopted. My mother, in short, could not have any children, and I was adopted. And I was never told this, because in Korea the adoption practice was that they would not tell the children. They would try to keep it a secret as long as possible, because they felt that if the children discovered that their biological parents gave them away for whatever circumstances, that news would be so damaging to their psychology that they would not become normal grown-ups. And so they tried not to tell. And so in our case, I didn't know until I was about to come to St. Louis University. And I discovered that my biological parents had three sons, including my twin brother. I have a twin brother, biological twin brother. And the reason I was given away, Koreans believed in many different kinds of religions and folk beliefs, including shamanism. And shamanism and folk beliefs, superstitions of the times said that when a twin brother and sister were born, they should not be kept together, not be raised together, because they might become too close. In other words, incestuous. And also, if they were raised together, the girl may drain luck away from the boy. And so the girl, one was always given away. Well, I wouldn't say always, but majority of the time, one was given away, and they never gave away the boy.
Did you ever meet your twin brother?
Yes, actually, I knew the twin brother, my biological family, all my life. But I thought they were my parents' friends. Okay. So I knew my brothers too, including my twin. But I thought they were sons of my parents' friends.
Mm-hmm. And what about your half-brothers and sisters? No, they aren't even your half-brothers and sisters, are they? The children your father and the mistress bore.
Right, right. I am in good contact with them. They are very good kids. They are now all grown. And this is what Confucianism means. When the first boy grew up and they got a job, and as they were growing up, they were taught by their mother and by neighbors, everybody, that they should really respect my mother as their mother and their biological mother as a secondary mother. And so they respected my mother, they were told to. And so when the first boy went to work and got paid, he brought the entire salary of the month to my mother. this is how children are taught to be respectful.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many instances of deep harm that have occurred here, but so much acts of deep love.
Yes.
In this story that you're telling, that are, it's very, very human experience type of story here.
Yes. That's why I wrote this book. I would say Confucian male-centered values through these main characters down into some very difficult situations, heartbreaking situations. And yet, because of the teachings of living together in harmony, respecting one another, no matter what kind of circumstances they were put in, you respect them. You keep order in the house. You don't fight and scratch faces and pet hair, each other's hair out. You behave in a way Confucians behave, in harmony, in peace, with respect. And so I thought this was an extraordinary love story. My father and mother's hearts were broken, but they came out triumphant in terms of the love and respect and honor they showed one another.
And when you found out you were adopted, I was surprised by this, because what you talked about previously in this very strict adherence to only wanting male children, how did people wind up adopting girls?
Oh, okay. All right. Usually adoptions in Korea occurred within the family. Like if the oldest man had no male child, but the younger brother, one of the younger brothers, had many male children, they adopted one of the nephews. Mm-hmm. But they hardly ever adopted nieces. So adoptions were done usually among family. But non-family relations adoption was done too, in which case usually people just put a little girl wrapped up in a blanket and set it on the footsteps of a rich family so she would be taken care of. In my case, my adoptive parents' uncle was very good friend with the biological father, so he became the go-between.
But then this puts you as a girl baby in a very special, exalted position with your family, who was willing to take a baby girl.
Yes. Usually people were not willing to take baby girls unless the baby girl was found in their doorstep. But in my case, my parents were happy to have me, even though I was not a boy. And especially my mother, to her, I was everything. Because now even her husband was not wholly hers. She was sharing him with somebody else. The only thing she didn't have to share with anybody was me. And so I was everything to her. And I got all the love and care any girl would ever wish for.
I still have to bring this around, but you were still told you should have been a boy.
Yes. Yes. Some neighbors knew I was adopted, and so it was not really my fault, not being a boy was not really a direct cause of my parents having to get the mistress. But some neighbors didn't know that, and they did say, you should have been a boy. If you were a boy, your mother would not be in this. And actually, the day the mistress came, something very dramatic happens to my mother. And she becomes unconscious. And so this is why the neighbors came and picked her and fed her, spoon-fed her Chinese medicine. And they said, see that girl, they, if she was a boy, this would not have happened.
Yeah, it's her fault, yeah.
But a few years later, when my mother more or less could talk, she said she went to a fortune teller, and the fortune teller said, this girl, my daughter, will become 10 times better than a boy. And I was 5 years old when I heard this, and I thought, how do I become 10 times better than a boy? What do I do? Start wearing pants or something?
I had 10 pairs of pants.
Yeah. I had no idea. But one thing clear, it sounded like there was something I could do when I grew up. And that gave me hope. And so my memoir, when I wrote it, the title is 10 Times Better Than a Boy.
Ah, so there's another book out there. How do people find your books? How do they find out more about you?
Amazon.com. Uh-huh. And I have a website, www.MejaRee Divine. Ree is my middle name. So,
spell Meja Ree.
M-A-I-J-A, Ree, R-H-E-E, Divine, D-E-V-I-N-E.
And I suspect that a Google search would bring you up pretty quickly, too.
Yes.
So the books are at Amazon. And are any of them in audiobooks yet?
Oh, I really should get an audiobook done. I need to. Because I give talks a lot on this. And one student was a blind student. And he said, oh, I would love to have an audiobook. And I need to do that.
I would love to have an audiobook, too. I was presented with an autographed copy of your book.
Uh-huh.
And I will pass that around to the women here in the studio, because with my low vision, I am not able to read it very well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could really work hard at it and read it, but it's difficult. So audiobooks are great in my opinion.
Good.
Thank you.
Would you like me to say a few words about the Comfort Woman? My next book?
Yes, your next book, yes. And we don't have a whole lot of time, okay.
I've been so fascinated by this conversation that I knew we were supposed to talk about this, but we might have to have you on another time.
I'll be happy to come back.
We just may do that. But give us a quick...
Okay. I have been writing op-eds, essays, short essays, 600-word essays on different controversial issues concerning Comfort Women of World War II, mostly Korean women, 200,000 women, 11 to 19-year-old girls who were dragged away into comfort stations and having sex 20, 30 times a day. Anyway, 12 articles have already been published in the Korea Times, and that becomes the core of my next book.
Great. Well, we'll have to. When is that next book due to be out, do you think?
Maybe in the next couple of years.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Meja, for being a guest today. I think we're just about out of time. Does anybody have anything they want to add or ask? Or how many minutes do we have left?
We've got a couple minutes left. So what is the working title of your Comfort Women book right now?
Right now it's The Anatomy of Comfort Women Experience. But it may be too long. It, you know, how when it goes to the publishing house, they may recommend changing the title.
You know, one question that has always kind of nagged at my brain about Comfort Women, that title, how did the women themselves feel about it?
Women do not like it because... what they really don't like is sex slaves. Although UN sanctioned title for them is sex slaves, but it attaches too much stigma to that. And so what they prefer to be called is harmony, which means grandma.
That... It just doesn't come up, what the women themselves prefer to be called. And
they prefer to be called grandma.
I, mm-hmm.
Wow.
They don't really like comfort women either because they don't think they provided comfort. Yeah. They definitely didn't volunteer to provide comfort.
When we have you back to talk about this, I have a story about an experience in Thailand Vietnam War. And uh-huh. We'll talk about that next time.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and discussing this autobiographical novel, I should say. The novel's called The Voices of Heaven by Major Reed Devine, and it's available on Amazon. And stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf, who is actually here this week. And guess who's coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson? And stay tuned next week for another episode of Every Woman.
Who taught me no one ever fights alone.